Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Again, imagine we had a huge, both military, prosecutorial response, not just to the Capitol mob, but to, you know, everybody who's got a gun and some scary 3%er stuff on their bumper sticker, right? That would not look radically unlike, you know, what we saw after 9/11, right? And that was a pretty important factional division in American politics for a long time.
Ever since the inauguration of the Biden administration, we've focused our episodes on power, coalitions, and how everyone who's operating in our realignment America can think about the world. We started with Michael Lind. He talked about how everything our society comes down to fights over power. We then brought on Lee Drutman from New America, who spoke about how third parties and a multi-party democratic system could solve all these issues. And we're concluding this series with Professor Stephen Tells of Johns Hopkins University and senior fellow at the Niskanen Center. Steve has done two things that are really interesting for us. One, he recently has written Never Trump, Revolt of the Conservative Elites, which is interesting because it's not just a book about what Jonah Goldberg and the crew over the Lincoln Project have done. It's actually about the phenomenon of there's this whole course of people. There's this whole set ranging from the suburbs of Greenwich, Connecticut, all the way to the think tanks of Washington, D.C., who actually are Republicans but don't want Donald Trump. Where they go is one of the most important questions in American politics, which Sagar has always had great thoughts on. And then attached to that, in the real topic conversation during this episode, is his essay, The Future is Faction, which is all about the fact that despite the belief that many hold that moderation in both parties is doomed, the fact that the political system is so divided gives an opportunity for moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats in different ways to work to push their coalitions in different directions. Whether you're a moderate or not, this is a helpful episode because it's helping you understand once again how these coalitions and different power centers will work.
Yeah, exactly. Loved this episode with Steve. He's such an astute observer of coalitions and how they work. And the reason that we're emphasizing coalitions is, look, there is no one group that is dominant enough in order to rule America. Not one. And so if you are going to rule in America, you have to understand who are the people that you're partnering up with, what's the power relationship, the dynamic. Some people can change, some are exiting. Maybe you can be a little bit too self-policing because now all of a sudden you don't have that much of the country who's with you. You can never win a national election. Wonder who I'm talking about there. Anyway, look, it's a great episode. Highly recommend it. And I really got a lot out of it.
You guys know the deal. Subscribe to our Substack. It's in the show notes. Check out our YouTube channel. We're really enjoying actually putting video out there. And finally, go check out all of Steve's books at our bookshop.org shop. We get 10%. Support the show, but also support local bookstores and authors during the challenging COVID times.
That's right. Now it's time for realignment questions. Just as a reminder, if you want to ask us a question, you can leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and ask us your question within that rating, or take a screenshot of your 5-star review, send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com. What do we have this week, Marshall?
This question is from Apple Podcasts, B Dog McNug. A lot of you guys would have great Reddit names to sell your stonks and everything. Please let us know what those are. But here it is, Big Media Reckoning. We need Rachel Bovard or Matt Stoller on to talk about media censorship. I'm having trouble thinking about what we should do to fix the solution. Obviously, you don't want people inciting riots, but you also don't want censorship. I'm struggling to draw the line. Also, if you could dissect Section 230 and its implications, that'd be very helpful, since it seems there's a lot of misunderstanding around the legislation. Thanks. That is a great question, and we have a great answer for you. We have a special episode coming out this Friday that is focused directly on that topic, so look for this space. We love doing bonus ones that focus a little deeper on these pressing issues and help you understand the world a little better.
Yeah, that's right. It's a complicated issue, not really one that we could get into just here on the Q&A, but we've literally got one coming out on Friday, so stay tuned. And with that, we'll get to the episode. A special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We appreciate all the work that they help us do here. Let's dive in, guys.
Steve Tellis, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to see you, Steve.
Good to be seen.
All of that is the obvious reference to the fact that you all need to go watch the YouTube version of the video that we are now publishing on our channel. But getting into the actual conversation, Steve, everything you're focused on, factional politics, the past, present, and future of the Never Trump movement, the role of moderates in our political system perfectly dovetails with what we've been focusing on the last week or so of the podcast, which is all about after Trump, what does power, its influence, and its actual wielding of actually look like? So I want to start here with your piece, The Future is Faction, that we will link in the show notes and include on the Substack. You open with this fact that the conventional wisdom in our system right now is the idea that political moderation is effectively doomed. Either you're a Democrat and Joe Biden is the final, to quote you, last gasp of a specific generation of Democratic politicians, or you are a moderate Republican and you are an endangered species, especially on the national stage. I'll throw it to you, Sagar, to pick up on where we're going with it too.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm really interested in here, Steve, is that the last gasp idea kind of changes the way that we're going to think about this current trajectory. So just kick us off just with your general thesis in that, in your essay, The Future is Faction, which we'll have linked in the show notes, and then we'll get to interrogating it a little bit.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit. So the essay started as the conclusion for Never Trump. So we did a whole bunch of versions of it. The first one was published before the book came out, and then there was the conclusion of the book, and then we revised it later on for national affairs. So maybe we should just make it a completely live document and just keep changing it over time. But part of the idea is that we often, as political scientists, think about a lot of these questions as being structurally determined, right? There are big, you know, large societal forces that are determining what the basic choices that people have are. And, you know, so I'm teaching a class this semester at Johns Hopkins on polarization. And we often think about polarization as being driven by these deep structural forces in the economy or racial dynamics or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that me and my co-author, Rob Saldine at the University of Montana, were trying to do in this essay was to bring a little bit of agency back to that story. Right, not to just treat this as something that is predetermined by these large structural forces that are too big for anyone to do anything about, but to say that in part some of this polarization is a function of decisions that people have made, right? Investments that they made at one point in time that are then either bearing fruit or not bearing fruit later on. And one of the things that came out of this was thinking about some of the decisions that Never Trump people made when faced by this strange phenomenon of Trump that they had no parallel to think about, right? They didn't have anything that was like that they could use to determine what they should be doing rationally. And a lot of that organization was very much directed at Trump, right? They thought about this as a kind of emergency that they needed to respond to. A lot of that organization was generated on that basis, and it was generated in this very cross-partisan way, right? Where they say, oh, you know, we need a unified front of all, you know, people who are of goodwill to stand up to this, right? And that made a certain sense. But one of the things that didn't happen, that they didn't really do, was to create very specifically Republican factional organization to counter Trumpism, right? And so that's essentially what we are pointing out in this essay, is that a lot of that, the decline of, you know, again, moderates is a very slippery term and I don't love it. And we actually tried to scrub as many references to moderate in the last version as we could, because I actually don't think that's the basic factional line of conflict here, although it's related to the basic factional line of conflict. But again, the big thing that non-Trump conservatives, however you want to describe them, didn't do is they did not create durable factional organization with which to contest for power in the Republican Party with the Trumpist faction, right? They didn't go out and create a lot of new think tanks. They didn't, you know, they created some new magazines. They didn't create a lot of new, you know, state by state organizations to engage in hand to hand combat in for state parties. They didn't go out and mobilize a lot of people, right? They didn't go out and create, you know, anti-Trump, you know, clubs in various.
Quick thing on this, because I'm just coming to mind immediately. What's the Lincoln Project then? Because the Lincoln Project's entire argument is that that's what they're doing. We're spending all this money. We're getting in Trump's head. We're activating voters. How does that fit into your framework?
Well, right. So remember, right, whatever you think of the Lincoln Project, right, it was not an omnicompetent organization doing everything, right? Mm-hmm. They cut ads, right? That's what they did. Because that's who they were, right? They were guys who made ads, right? They were political consultants, and they did the kind of things that political consultants do, right? Political consultants are not organizers, right? So notice the phrase that you use, right? They activated voters, right? Well, that's got a very specific meaning in the business, right? They weren't organizing people. They weren't connecting them horizontally to one another, right? Which is what organizing is. It's not just connecting people to some center thing where they send money and then ads get spit out, right? They, you know, they turn people into cadres, right? And that's where a lot of power comes from, right? That's why historically evangelicals have had a lot of power. It's not just they were connected to these central organizations, because the central organizations came and went, right? They disappeared, but a lot of that horizontal connections that people had to one another, that cadre kind of form of organization, persisted. And that's what really didn't happen, right? We had 4 years where there was the possibility of creating not probably a majority faction, right, but a pivotal minority faction without which the rest of the Republican Party could not govern, right? That for me was the central way to both hem in Trump, right, and to create a contest for power afterwards, right? And that's what for the most part didn't get created. Right. And there's lots of reasons why. I'm not entirely sure why that wasn't. Right. I've got some hypotheses. But so in that sense, the people who are challenging the sort of Trumpist populist for power are starting way behind. Right. They're starting 4 years behind of where they needed to do in terms of that fundamental organization of finding the people who believe what they believe. Right. To, to giving them ideological content about what that should be, to turning them into a fighting force, right? And you could see this by the fact that every one of the people who resisted or challenged Trump got picked off one by one, right? Mm-hmm. Flake, Corker, right? All of them, because they all had a strategy of essentially trying to individually differentiate themselves. But what that meant is, right, you could easily knock them off one at a time, right? If they had held together, if they had actually done a blood oath in a basement somewhere, right, and said, we're all going to stick together and the Republican Party can't govern without us as a team, right, then it would have been very hard to dismiss or ignore or marginalize them, right? But mm-hmm. that's what they never do.
So I know you said that you dropped moderate from the final version of this, but I think especially for our listeners, it's important to go into the dynamics of what quote unquote moderation looks like, because what makes this such a confusing dynamic is in many ways, Donald Trump is a moderate. And in many ways, Donald Trump ran as a moderate. In many ways, Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona reads as moderate, but his policies on especially entitlement programs, economic libertarianism are not moderate. I'd say he's probably much further to the right than Donald Trump is on economic policy questions. So can you just break up what that actually means, at least if people conceive of it?
Yeah. So this does, again, get at the point of how I've been thinking about this over time, right? So there's a reason I dumped moderate, there's a sense in which I think moderate does actually mean something, But I don't think it means anything in terms of the central ideological division between between these factions, right? And in a way, it's a little easier to see that in the Democratic Party, right? And so part of the discussion in the paper is about these factional conflicts on the Republic, on the Democratic side, right? So the Democratic side really does have a powerful minority faction, right? Whether you call it the DSA squad, right? I mean, they have all of the things you associate with an intra-party faction. Again, in a faction, you can think of as like frenemies with the rest of the party, right? They're both trying to contest for control of that party, and yet they're in that party and they want to beat the other party, right? So they're playing a two-sided game. That's what makes them a faction. And in the paper, we say, you know, this is the substitute we have for third parties in the United States, right? Other countries have this heterogeneity of ideological positions, and they manage it through having a bunch of different parties, right? But because of the structure of American institutions, all that heterogeneity has to get processed into two parties, and it therefore gets manifested in these internal party factions, right? So the Democrats, we argue, eventually will develop one, this DSA faction, and it's already got most of what, you know, it's got magazines, it's got clubs, it's got people who get together in bars in Brooklyn and hook up and meet each other and, like, you know, gossip about each other, right? It's got its own fundraising structures, its own political consultants, right? It's got all its own apparatus, right? And it's got its own ways to connect people horizontally as well as up to central kind of organizations, right? Then in the Democratic Party, there's like what you can think of as the establishment faction, the dominant, the Joe Biden faction, right? Mm-hmm. And that's less defined ideologically than it's defined organizationally, right? Traditionally, the Democratic Party was a log roll of interests, right? You had a sort of mainstream African-American, you know, component. You had environmentalists, you had feminists, you had, you know, public sector unions, right? And they were in a kind of, again, a log roll, right? Where they had agreed to all support each other's thing in exchange for supporting everybody else's thing, right? That's what Joe Biden thinks the Democratic Party is, right? It's that deal, and the Democratic Party is whatever comes, its ideology is whatever comes out of the negotiation between those interests, right? And then finally, you had a kind of right of, you know, that what you, what actually is moderate, right? Moderate Democratic, you know, group that's more pro-business, that's more pro-free trade, more pro-immigration, but on economic grounds, all that kind of stuff, right? That's the fact, the, you know, increasing, or and part of that is generated by the fact of the emergence of the DSA wing, right? The more they mobilize, the more everybody else has to actually respond in kind, right? So there's a reason why, like, Abby Spanberger immediately came out after the election and was like,
yes,
the DSA did it, right? Because, you know, she's having to generate a distinct brand because she's worried that the DSA brand is going to get on her. The mud's going to get on her. So she needs some kind of form of organization to differentiate her brand from that. So she can say, hey, voters of Virginia, of Orange County or wherever, right? When you think about me, don't think about the squad, right? I'm there fighting the squad. So when you're voting for me, you're not also voting for them, right? Now, the Republican division is more complicated, right? And I'm not entirely sure what the factional division that is. Originally, I had what I think is closer to y'all's definition, which is a more economic definition of what that factional conflict was going to be, right? Although even then, I think it's more complicated, right? So this is the sort of working class Republican idea. That would be the dominant faction. And then the minority would be what's left of the country club Republican faction. I wonder, kind of after, you know, after the Capitol riot, whether that will actually be the factional divide, right? You know, again, the fact that Tom Cotton was on one side of that, right, rather than where Josh Hawley was, right? And some of the divides we have in politics are a function of the agenda, right? Mm-hmm. If the agenda was primarily economic, it would make sense to have factional divides that were on trade and immigration and industrial policy and all the stuff you guys talk about, right? But what if the politics, the agenda of the next 2 years or 4 years is about internal insurrection, right? What if
let's actually discourse this, because this is something I'm like absolutely obsessed with, Steve. And I think you're 100% right. I recommend everybody go read Ross Douthat's latest column in the New York Times, because he identifies exactly this. The title is Trump Ate Populism, something I've been talking about here for the last couple of weeks, which is that whenever things got polarized along the lines of Stop the Steal, we now have a situation, in my opinion, where what you're talking about, the country club faction, is just totally irreconcilable with the Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz faction. No, you know, better example than the fact that Matt Gaetz is literally right now on his way to Wyoming in order to campaign against Liz Cheney, whose entire Republican Party has just censored her in her own home state. I think we all know she's a dead woman walking in that primary. So when we look at the irreconcilability of those two factions, and this is how I'm kind of tying it back to what you just talked about and why I'm actually skeptical Biden will be the last moderate, is why shouldn't Liz Cheney just be a Democrat? And or not even just her, why should a voter who is animated by Liz Cheney, by Mitt Romney, by that upper income Republican, not just fully go into the Democratic Party? Something we talked a lot here about the primary in terms of the division of the electorate along class lines is, I don't think it's a secret about why Joe Biden revised the "I won't raise taxes on anyone over $400,000 a year rather than $250,000, which Obama promised back in 2008. Because that's exactly these kind of never Trump constituency, to the extent there was one, that existed. Except here's the thing, and you know, a lot of the DSE people made fun of it. That actually worked. Like, those are the people who literally won Biden the election, because if you look down ballot, if Trump had performed just as well as Republicans down ballot, he probably would have won re-election. So there's a lot there. I'm curious for your thoughts, though, particularly on that Republican coalition
point. That's one of those good questions where there were four questions there. Yes. I can answer any one I want. So one thing is just to go back a little bit to, you know, what we think the building blocks of these factional divisions will be, right? And one way to think about this is, well, it's voters, right? There are voter groups out there, and they will eventually find a leader of some sort, right? But the groups themselves are the fundamental, original, they're the unmoved mover, right, of the system, right?
Right.
And I don't believe that. I think in general, you know, people who are suppliers of organization are the unmoved mover, right? They are the ones who are the original source, and then they go out looking for supporters, right? Mm-hmm. And who, right, you know, who they eventually recruit and mobilize is a function in part of skill, right? Because again, remember, going back to the point, there's multiple different identities people have that can be activated as the primary and most important form of their political identity, right? And that is an underdetermined factor, right? And one that organization can have a lot to do with, right? And so this again goes back to my point is, will those factional divides be primarily economic, or will they primarily be about, like, how do you feel about the people who are, you know, who are, again, if we imagine we had a huge both military prosecutorial response, not just to the Capitol mob, but to, you know, everybody who's got a gun and some scary 3% or stuff on their bumper sticker, right? Mm-hmm. That would not look radically unlike, you know, what we saw after 9/11, right? And that was a pretty important factional division in American politics for a long time, right? That was a big thing that divided the parties, right? Is how they felt about that, right? And you could see that be the dominant divide in American politics, right? And if it was, then, right, Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley are on different sides.
What I appreciate about all of that is you hit upon something Sagar and I have changed our minds about over the course of the show in terms of whether economics or culture are the defining issue as parties realign, form new coalitions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at least for me, and I'm curious how you said you would have thought you used to agree with that framework of ours. I want to know, when did your mind start to change? What I'll say, and then I want to hear from Sagar, is from my perspective, it was the RNC, the Republican National Convention, in August 2020, when you saw Nicholas Sandilin of Indiana speaking about the Washington Post and the culture war. You saw the Trump campaign create an entire campaign that was focused on cultural grievance, focused on leaning into the culture wars. And I realized, holy crap, they figured it out. You could entirely lean into the idea that the Republican Party is the party of the quote unquote working class. It's the party of people who don't have graduate degrees, while also saying, but by the way, we're going to pass tax cuts. And that's totally chill. As long as at the same time, you're diving into those cultural vices. But Sagar, where was it for you? And I want to know, Steve, where your thinking started to shift.
Okay, let me go back in time then a little bit. So I'll go to Steve Mark One, and then we'll go to Steve Mark Two. Mark Two is like way messier and like not totally together right now. So I'll just stipulate that. So, I mean, Mark One basically, again, was an economic theory, right? It basically said that the pivotal actors in this system are those more or less middle class professionals, right? The people you were talking about who are like, you know, covered in the $400,000 cap, right? But though, you know, suburban Philadelphia, all those kind of people, right? And that they were going to split between the two parties and form factions in either party. And the ones in the Republican Party would be a little more socially conservative, right? They would be people who probably went to church, right? And then when you think about their funding base, right, not their mass base, but their funding base,
yep,
in the Democratic Party, that's Silicon Valley, right? And in the Republican Party, it's more likely to be finance, right? So the finance people are going to fund the what I call the liberal conservative faction in the Republican Party. And tech is going to fund the sort of woke capitalism.
That still true?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember I looked at some of the breakdown on the Trump-Biden right before the election. So in terms of finance, it's complicated, right? So like it was, I think Biden did better. Biden and Kamala raised the most amount in Wall Street history. And I think that in terms of high net worth individuals, by and large, they are the ones who got it more than ever. But there was also a substantive high net worth population, mostly of oil and gas people in Texas, who were like the major Trump funders. Like Texas was the financial nexus of the Trump campaign, which I thought was interesting.
Right. So this is where, again, this is a little complicated. So again, when you think about what I would think of as the dominant, what I'll call populist, but I don't like that phrase either. Mm-hmm. Faction, right?
Okay, real quick, after you give this answer, please tell why you don't like the pot. You keep on dropping useful things, so please follow up on that afterwards.
All right. Okay. So when you think about that dominant faction, right? And again, in all these, there's like the voter base, there's the funding sources, right? And they aren't always aligned, right? And the weird thing about that potentially dominant populist faction, right, is it's got a funding base, as Sagar was talking about, of extractive industries and low-wage employers, right? Those are the people who are like the most Trumpy rich people, right? Or people who dig up oil, right? And the people who employ low-wage workers, right? And again, this is the weird thing, they've got those employers plus their employees, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, a lot of that base, right? Now, who's not in that, right? Wall Street, for the most part, is not in that. But I do think that they're a potential more logical funding source for a minority liberal conservative faction, right? That's more like the old Koch Republican, right? You know, hopefully more modernized. They got better ideas. They're not just like, you know, bring zombie Reaganism, right? But socially, that's, you know, it's suburban, more religious, basically market-oriented voters and more conservative, not sort of California, you know, very secular, wealthy people like are the ones who are going to be funding the Democratic Party. So that was my original, almost purely economic theory of the divide. But again, that was assuming that the economic was the overall dominant agenda item.
Yes.
Yeah. And what's on the agenda, right, is not a fixed thing, right? That changes, right? And often can last for a very long time, right? If social order is, right, is the dominant agenda item, right? And again, in some ways we think there's both, if there's, we have, a, let's say this summer, we had urban riots and we had, you know, white people with guns, you know, going into state capitals, right? Mm-hmm. Well, then the overwhelming dominant issue would not be about what, you know, what sort of changes to the welfare state or social insurance or industrial policy we should have, right? They would all be about social order questions. That would be the dominant question. That would be what voters would think they were supposed to be voting on. And that's where, you know, where activists would end up sorting themselves around.
So, you know, it's fascinating.
Sagar, to cut in, the populist answer, why don't you like populism as a framework? Because once again, that's another cohort that people are thinking about.
Well, so why don't I like that term? I don't think that term tells me anything, right? Now, unfortunately, it feels like a term people use as a placeholder where some more substantive term should belong, right? So again, you can apply it to Bernie Sanders, you can apply it to Josh Hawley, right? You know, I you know, it's obviously got cultural components to it. It has lots of other things. It just feels a little underspecified as to what it's actually talking about, right? And that's why I haven't found a substitute term, right? Nationalist is not bad. But the thing that actually holds this group together doesn't seem well described by just calling it populist.
I think you're exactly right. And, you know, it's, and we talk about this here too all the time. We're like, look, populism is a political vehicle. It's not a policy platform. It's not, you know, it's literally just a means to an end of a type of politics. And getting back to what you're talking about, by the way, I agree. I mean, you know, probably bought a little bit too much into the economic thesis around Trump, about the dividing lines within the Republican Party and more. And what was a useful check, and when I started to doubt things, was actually during the campaign, because you could see that, as you said, the most diehard people for Trump were like those boat parades. Right. And you're like, OK, these are
humble,
not like, yeah, the boat people and like the boat parade people are not like downwardly mobile steel workers from Ohio. They're like rich, upwardly mobile, non-college educated, largely whites who are culturally all in on Trump. And that's when I was like, well, there's something going on here.
They own the car washes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They own the car wash. They're like, you know, I'm not going to say they're millionaires or whatever. I'm not denigrating, by the way. A lot of these people are like small business people. All good. Nothing wrong with that. But they're also the type of people who were all in for Mitt Romney. And they were also all in for like Bush. It's just that now they're like a little bit more of a dick in public because of Trump. And then you can see that that wasn't really translating. But the fascinating part is, as you say, now we live in a political system and have a coalition where if you're in Alabama, both that person who owns the car wash and many of the people who work at the car wash all voted for Trump. And they did so because of a shared cultural value system. And as I can as I see it, Steve, is that everything is kind of oriented around, it's just as close as we can get to it. This is why I no longer use the words working class to describe this, even though many of the people who are working class fall into it, is that the dividing line more than ever just seems to be four-year college degree. Every bit of data that I look at is like, if you have a four-year college degree and majority in your county, you're 75% likely to vote Biden. If you don't, 50 majority, then you're almost 75% likely to vote Trump. Same thing when it came to the donations. in terms of the county by county data that we've had for 2020, that's mostly what it looks like. So you basically have, and again, class is not the right denominator because we think of class in economic terms when it's becoming much more around the acculturating process of while you're in college, the type of values or, you know, even the type of media you watch and more versus people who don't go through that experience. Like that just seems the current divide in American politics.
Right, let me try something else out as a way to riff off of that, right? Which is to think about education as a subset of something bigger than that, right? Now, one way to think about this is, you know, the Democratic Party really used to be the party of the losers, right? Mm. Go back, you know, to the 40s and 50s, you know, it was like farmers and, you know, very rough, you know, workers, miners, you know, that's who the Democratic Party was, right? The big thing that happens, and I discussed this in my book, The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, available at all better bookstores. You know, the big thing that happens is we get a growing share of workers are professionals of various sorts, right? That's, you know, now you can look at that in terms of, okay, they have a degree, right? But I think the more important thing is they are members of some kind of profession, right? Some kind of organized body of knowledge and certification, right? Now, this also shows up in the economy, right? We have a larger, you know, percentage of people who require a license to do what they do. That's part of the professionalization project, right? And that those professionals become the anchor tenants of the Democratic Party, right? All of those professions, law, medicine, public health, you know, the academia, right? The Democratic Party becomes their party just as much as farmers and workers were the anchor tenant of the earlier Democratic Party, right? And it's not an accident that to some degree, the Republican Party organizes itself and increasingly manifests as the anti-professional party, right? There's not an accident that so much of the energy of, you know, conservatives is just sort of attacking universities, saying how horrible they are, right? Because, you know, it's in fact true that they are part of this extended party network, right? Mm-hmm. That is, you know, when you think about parties, the really core is like the office holders, and then you get, you know, people who are political consultants, but then there's all these organizations that are part of that larger way that parties do their work, right? And, you know, professional schools, universities, the professions themselves are all, right, really now in the Democratic Party. And so it's not also an accident that so much of our politics is professionalism versus anti-professionalism, right? What is the big slogan Democrats have, right? Trust science, trust scientists, right? And so much of the Republican thing has been about skepticism about what professionals are saying, attacking professionals, right? And I think that is a way of thinking about what this conflict between the two parties is as well. And the economic is in a way is superimposed over that professional versus non-professional divide, right? And it's also in a way divided between professional managers, right? People who go and get MBAs and get degrees in colleges, right? Versus the kind of guys you were talking about who are the ones who own the chain of car washes, right? But that sociologically, I think, begins to start making the conflict between those two parties make sense.
Yeah.
And what's so funny about, well, it's not funny if you're a DSA person, but you really, you hear everything you just said and you understand why the DSA wing of the Democratic Party is stuck in this really difficult position where in many ways, like we're making the jokes about Brooklyn. I know that there are UAW members who are DSA who listen to the show, but at least within our imagination, a lot of the DSA folks that I know are college grads who for a variety of reasons aren't satisfied with their situation, but it's not as if they're the working class people. In many ways, they're the professionals that you're speaking to. So they are sorted in the right part of the party, but there's also not a market within the Democratic Party for attacking the professions, for attacking those industries the same way. But it's not as if they could become Republicans. So there is just this generally difficult spot.
Although I do think there is an interesting potential factional conflict over time between, again, your DSA types and your mainstream Democrat, because when you think of the mainstream Democratic Party, those core professional organized interests, right? They're the core of that Bidenite establishment, old Koch Democratic Party, right? And those are the successful people of the professions, right? One way to think of the DSA people, right, is in some ways, you know, they're like the lumpen professoriate, right? They're the people who, you know, who are the people who are writing for a lot of the, you know, left-wing publications, right? They're the people who are part of this, you know, part-time academic, right? They didn't get like their fancy job at Harvard, right? You know, and they're angry, right? They're angry that they got all this education and yet they don't have a position that's like appropriate to it, right? And I think that provides a lot of the energy and a lot of the anger that you see among the DSA. You know, again, that's a big group, big heterogeneous group, but I think that's one of the characteristics. And you could see conflicts there between the people who are the successful professional parts of the Democratic Party and these outsiders, right, who aren't simply associating the interests of the left or liberalism with, you know, giving more and additional resources to the existing successful professions.
So we've done a good job of laying the table, both how we've all thought about the 2016 to 2020 period. Let's look to the future, because the whole point of futurist faction, the whole point of this framework is people need a mental model for moving forward. But before we get there, I just want to ask you a quick question about moderation that came up when I read the essay. You talk a bit about how there are negative consequences of moderation falling away. And as you know, we have a Q&A portion, and a question we got from a listener recently was, I feel, and I'm quoting the listener, I feel as if the only time anything gets done in DC is it's the two parties coming together to screw everyone. So that would be, in this person's idea, probably Glass-Steagall, the Iraq War, bailouts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why is it that people should root for gridlock to end when for many listeners, when from the perspective of many listeners, gridlock, sorry, from the perspective, edit that, Phil, from the perspective of many listeners, the only time Washington works is when it's not working for the quote unquote people. That's the anti-establishment case.
Okay. So that's a complicated question, right?
We
so
have brilliant listeners who ask us very good questions.
I'll break it up into a couple of pieces, right? One, simply as a political science matter, this book that Francis Lee and Jim Curry just published argues that it is in fact historically the case that almost all major legislation gets passed with significantly bipartisan majorities, right? And so it's not, you know, the reason that we have had less legislative productivity over the last 20 years is that it's harder to pass things with cross-party majorities, right? Because the parties are more polarized, they're more disciplined, right, to keep defectors from making coalitions with the other party, right? But it's still mostly the only way to get anything done. And as a consequence, we just don't get anything done, right? Except under emergency conditions, right? So Phil Wallach at AAI has actually written about this, about what you can think of as sort of emergency bipartisanship, right? Mm-hmm. And so like when the entire world is coming apart, right? Well, then people can do them. And part of that, I think, is a little bit that you get a dynamic of blame avoidance that takes over, right? So nobody wants to be the party that gets blamed for, you know, bringing on the apocalypse, right? So that's why you can get, you know, significant bipartisan majorities on emergency stuff. Now, whether you're, you know, your reader is right or not about whether or not those are the kind of things that also tend to screw working class people is a little bit of a matter of taste. I'm not going to go into that. But well, I mean, it's right that it seems like for now, that's the only basis upon which we make majorities across parties. Now, part of the point of the Futurist Faction essay is to say that the way out of a lot of our governance problems is looser and less disciplined parties, right? Mm-hmm. That is, there's well-established argument in political science called conditional party government theory that basically says the power of party leaders is a function of how homogeneous their party caucus is, right? When their party caucus all agrees, they're going to be willing to give a lot of power over to their leaders, and also to agree to only make coalitions with other members of the party, right? And what I was arguing in this essay is, imagine a world in which those internal differentiators start to become stronger, right? What happens when you do that, when you play that out? Well, the first thing that happens is those factions are going to stop being willing to transfer that power over to their leaders. You're going to have less centralized agenda control, right? Because let's just take Josh Hawley or Josh Hawley, like three, we'll go in the Wayback Machine and go back to the bizarro Josh Hawley of 3 weeks ago, right? You know, he might want to spend a lot of time making coalitions with Democrats on trade, on IP, right?
Which he did, actually. Yeah.
But, well, but not a lot of productive legislative ones. He did a lot of this coalition, right? But sure. Not a lot of actually, you know, creating legislative vehicles and passing them, right? Getting them onto the floor of Congress, right? But to the degree to which there's a significant number of people in each party who really want to make coalitions with the other, they're going to demand rules that allow for that, right? And so when we were talking about that economic working class, whatever, you know, however you want to describe that, right? One thing that does is that changes the agenda, right? To being an agenda in which Republicans are basically homogenous and Democrats are basically homogenous, to an agenda where a significant number of members are going to want to make coalitions with each other, right? So in mine, those moderate Democrats are also going to want to make coalitions with liberal conservatives on immigration and trade and, you know, and stuff like that, right? And therefore, they're going to tell their leaders that, you know, their deal for going along with the party is that ability to make those cross-party coalitions, right? Now, those may be different than the emergency bipartisanship coalitions that Marshall was asking about.
Right? Yeah. The question, though, is that how do you manage any of this with a primary system which is going to skewer anybody who does do that, right? So, like, I mean, I'll go back to Liz Cheney, which is that Liz Cheney, you know, by quote unquote working with the Democrats to impeach Trump, effectively ends her political career in the Republican Party. Same thing, I think, probably with Tom Rice in South Carolina, who's all but admitted this. But let's say, let's advocate for that listener a little bit. What are the actual bipartisan things that happen in Congress in a non-emergency situation? Liz Cheney working with Max Rose, Democrat, who actually lost the re-election, in order to keep troops in Afghanistan and block, you know, the NDAA and the ability to permanently keep, I think, 4,500 troops there. So there is a bipartisan consensus that does get reinforced in, you know, in a non-emergency way. It's just not something necessarily that aligns with, I guess, the more populist, whatever, you know, the anti-establishment critique. More what I'm getting at is, unless you are working cross-party lines in that manner, you're just absolutely going to get skewered by your internal party mechanisms. I mean, I heard recently, I think Tulsi Gabbard, she was on Joe Rogan's podcast. She was talking about how, like, one time she literally just gave John Boehner a high five because they were both, like, doing a yoga class together or whatever. And she was actually admonished by a member of Democratic leadership being like, hey, you shouldn't be seen doing that. I mean, that's an extreme example, but that internal coalitional management kind of directly works against what you're talking about here. Like, I don't see a way out of our previous guest, Lee Drutman, called it a two-party doom loop. I kind of agree with him on this front.
Yeah, well, so Lee has been an old friend of mine, and I actually think a lot of our our diagnosis is actually very similar, right? Yeah. I actually don't think there's a way to get from here to there, right? And I think the things that he thinks that you're going to get out of having multi-party democracy, you can also get out of intra-party democracy, right? Now, just to go back to the Liz Cheney example, right? Again, the problem that Liz Cheney has is individualism, right? You know, that is, if she was out there organizing a distinct group of Republicans in Wyoming, right, to say, look, we're the normies, right? That's what, you know, and that, you know, that's one, also one way to think about what the divide is, right? Between, you know, the crazies, the QAnon, right? There's them, And then there's all of us, the people who think of themselves as just normal, God-fearing, you know, Republicans, right? Who don't believe crazy, you know, crazy stuff, right? You know, she could be organizing that. She could be getting funding, you know, donors who are associated with that. There could be clubs of people like that, right? And it would be a lot easier to defend yourself in the primary, right? But again, the point is that you act, that it's the crazies who are organized, right? That is the dominant fact of American politics, right? Is it's people who believe crazy things who are willing to actually put in the work of democratic politics, right? Who show up, right? You know, you can get 20,000 crazy QAnon, sometimes Confederate people to show up in the Capitol, right?
Sure.
So yeah. I have to ask this because I'll do something that will piss off each half of the audience for different reasons. Then why does it seem like there's an asymmetric crazy issue? I got in a fight with one of my Wall Street Journal friends. He was talking about Portland, where I'm from, and he says, look, the Democrats, the Republicans, yeah, we have a QAnon problem, but the Democrats have an Antifa problem. And I'm like, dude, Antifa does not determine the outcome of any single primary in this entire country. And if like our definition
of
crazy,
hate the Democratic leadership, they like,
yeah. And if our definition of crazy is like AOC, then that's just not crazy. So what explains the ability? And I think what I suspect you would put forth is the idea that there is a bigger gap in the between like what a Republican base member wants and what the DC establishment Republican Party wants than the gap between Democrats and like the Democratic base. So my point is there seems to be less actual room for crazies to exploit any perception gap on the Democratic side. But what do you think broadly about that conundrum?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think one difference is, you know, I mean, again, Antifa is not very big, right? I actually think in some ways for Democrats, and I'm a Democrat, I should just admit that I'm a Democrat. You know, there are very big problem from movements of the left because they're like a parasite, right? That grows and is attracted to regular movements, right? It's not an accident that somebody else organizes BLM movements, and I've got criticisms of BLM too, which we can get into, right? But they show up at their things and then assimilate into it, right? And then that ends up affecting the overall brand of that activity, right? And the same thing was true with, you know, anti-globalization things going back to Seattle and all of that, right? So, you know, I actually do think Antifa, you know, is not a big, you know, threat to actual social order unless you're a downtown businessman in Portland, right? But they're a very significant threat to the Democratic Party, right? Which is why I always thought, you know, why were Democrats not actually getting out front, right? Because with Antifa, it's really Democrats they hate more than anybody.
Yeah.
But the answer is pretty straightforward. The answer is they didn't do it because it was too tied to the nationalization of politics. And what's funny is what happened in Portland is the second that Donald Trump lost, Mayor Ted Wheeler is like, Antifa, you've gone too far. But back in June and July, they didn't exist. But to get back to my question, though.
Can I say, praying like guys who are, you know, coming like that is the future of the Democratic Party, right? They are going to realize that actually repressing, you know, Antifa and Antifa is like a shorthand for a lot of kinds of activity, right? That drawing that line is actually enormously organizationally and reputationally important for them, right? Mm-hmm. And it should have been last summer, and it absolutely will be now that they own the government.
Well, one second here, because, you know, I'm thinking about this from the Republican side. You know, in terms of the QAnon stuff, look, and when we're talking QAnon, what I'm saying, I think more broadly, maybe you too, Steve, although you can correct me, is not like I believe Q exists and all the, you know, pedophile stuff. It's like I think the election was stolen. Well, the problem is that's like 70% of Republicans in this country. So like there's not a lot to be done in terms of a Republican elite or establishment member, so to speak, where you can't police this necessarily because it's a downstream effect. Like your base already believes this because they like Trump and they always have trusted Trump much more than anything they've ever had to say. So it just seems like a bigger problem for the right. Marshall, what do you think?
Quick thing. I do think we should differentiate When I say QAnon, I actually do mean QAnon.
Oh, like literal QAnon.
Right. I think because there is a huge difference between Stop the Steal excess. And there's a lot of excess. Even the moderate version of Stop the Steal is an inherently destructive idea. It's not possible to just ask questions about Stop the Steal and then frankly not have it end the way January 6th ended. Yeah. But I just want to say that there are two different things. So like that being said, Steve, I think Sagar's question was like the right one.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was like quite two questions ago. So what was the question?
No, it was. It's this. It's like you said. It's important reputationally for the Democrats to call out Antifa. Okay, but so if you are a Republican, Adam Kissinger, for example, Adam Kissinger ain't ever going to be a Republican nominee for anything, okay? And he's going to definitely get a primary. If he wins, it's because he's in a very unique district. That guy does not represent the actual Republican base. And again, I'm not lionizing them or saying, I'm saying, look, these people believe the election was stolen. So what do you do if you're a Republican politician?
So I think it's worth deconstructing what we think 70% of people think the election was stolen means. Mm-hmm. So again, this is like a survey question. People ask it, right? People give an answer, right? I do think it's worth interrogating a little bit what it is people think they're saying when they're saying that, right? I think there are people who believe, right, you know, that they actually have a very precise definition that they really, really believe there were like trucks of votes that were like in the middle of the night. And they had to believe that in very literal terms, right? I think there's some significant number of people who think they're being asked a question about communal identification, right? They're being asked, what kind of person are you, right? They're not really being asked like a precise informational question, right? They're being asked a question they think is equivalent of saying, you know, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican, right? So the question for them is entirely redundant to the partisan ID question, right? Yeah. And, you know, look, they believe that thing because their leaders have told them, right? The people, again, so they have a very strong identity. They know that they are, you know, they know they're Republicans, they know they're conservatives, right? But in most of these cases, most people don't have very precise ideas of what that means in policy terms, right? So again, I wrote this book called Prison Break, also available in all better bookstores, about why conservatives—
Don't worry, all your books will be listed on our bookshop, which is an excellent time to plug.
I'm gonna try and, this is like a drinking, I'm gonna hit all the books. So, but what, you know, essentially we argue is, right, there was a big change, at least in a significant number of conservatives on criminal justice, right? And that was largely driven from the top. Right, leaders started sending different signals about what the appropriate position was. Right, they didn't convert people from being conservatives. Right, they were saying the appropriate conservative position now is that you should be more worried about excessive sentencing and, you know, favor of right. You know, that stuff starts from the top. It didn't well up from the bottom. Right, just like the belief that, you know, if Trump, you know, on, you know, right after the election had said, you know, sucks, I'm going to go back to Florida and I can actually, you know, go back to having affairs now and I don't have to make pretense anymore. Peace out, right? I'm going to Dubai, right? Would people have been going out there having these beliefs the election was stolen?
No way.
No.
Yeah.
No. So I think one thing that suggests is some of those beliefs may be highly susceptible to leadership cues,
yes.
Right? And to the degree to which leaders think, one, right, that they created a monster that's now devouring the reputation of the Republican Party with normies, right? And we got to really reel this in and start telling people something else, right? You can't reel in the Stop the Steal stuff, but people are going to forget about that, right? But we can't, you know, American politics cannot be a Ruby Ridge every month, right? But that's what it's going to be if we keep having these cycles of constantly agitating our base to believe that we're in the last days of the Republic, right? And so I do think in some sense, some of those beliefs are not just, you know, as you were sort of suggesting, they were bottom-up things that Republicans just believe.
Yeah. Right?
Some of them can be susceptible to change by office holders, by leaders, right?
And I think that's a really important point, yeah.
And I think it may be susceptible, especially if you find ways to create a synthesis between the anti-insurrectionist side and a kind of reformist economic kind of agenda, right? Mm-hmm. That can sort of pull this thing together and then sort of marginalize the most dangerous parts of this coalition, which in fact may also be marginalized directly through state repression. Right. And I say repression, not necessarily as a bad thing. So,
So Steve, we are nearing the end, but I have good news for you. It appears as if we've turned, we've scored the hat trick. We have the final reference to another book. That is, if you're listening, The Captured Economy, How the Powerful Enrich Themselves, Slow Down Growth and Increase Inequality. So in the name of the worst pivot of all time, how does the idea of a captured economy relate to everything we've been discussing for the past 55 minutes for our last question?
So, okay, so it absolutely does relate. So I've actually been thinking about industrial policy a lot recently, and my colleagues at the Scannon Center, like Sam Hammond, who's an old friend of your podcast, has been doing so too. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is we often think about industrial policy as about additional government activity. Right. That's
what real quick. Could you just define what you mean by industrial policy?
I'm about to get there. Right. So I'm starting with the bad definition here. Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Industrial policy means subsidy and protection of existing, business interests. That's the bad definition. Right. So we've got some sort of businesses and we're going to have an active government to come in and protect and subsidize. And right. Whereas one point of the Captured Economy book, right, is that we, in a way, have had a huge industrial policy for the last 30 or 40 years, right? But it's been industrial policy to subsidize the growth of, finance, insurance, real estate, right? That sector, right? We've had enormous subsidies, right? The whole creation of securitized finance industry was, in fact, an enormous subsidy for the growth of that particular sector, right? All of the tax subsidies we have are subsidies for that, right? When you think about the enormous expansions of intellectual property protection, which we talk about in the book, right? That's all a subsidy for one kind of economic activity, right? It's not like, and this is where I don't like the people who talk about our last 40 years as being neoliberalism, right? This terrible neoliberalism, right? And we need to replace it with something else, right? I keep saying, thinking about neoliberalism the way that, Gandhi said about Western civilization, he said it'd be a very good thing, right? Neoliberalism wouldn't be such a bad thing. I don't think it's what we've had, right? I think, in fact, the whole argument of the book is the last 40 years has been an expansion of the upward redistributing parts of the economy, the massive subsidy for that, right? And a hollowing out of a lot of our industrial productive capacity, right? So real industrial policy for me is Janus-based, right? It has what you guys often talk about, which is we need to have, we need to rethink the way our economy and industry is wrapped up with China, right? There's all that part.
Right.
But then there's also all the stuff of having to, to push down on the parts we've been subsidizing and protecting, which all turn out also to have these very regressive implications. And I think in a way, a lot of that is all behind a lot of the anti-system politics, both on the left and the right, right? And that if you really need industrial policy, it has to have both of these components of getting us out of the things we've been subsidizing, as well as getting into some other stuff.
I couldn't agree with that more. Yeah.
I was going to end it, but I have to have a quick follow-up because we've been host to a lot of the anti-neoliberal conversations, and it's good to get both sides. It's actually good to get both sides of the issue out. Is it possible, though, that we could obviously argue that neoliberalism isn't responsible for X, Y, and Z thing we don't like, but what if it's inherently just tied up in it, right? So what if what starts as the good intention of, hey, government was too bloated in the 70s, hey, well, actually it turns out the market can do things. I think an anti-neoliberal would argue that those intuitions, even if true in the 70s, inevitably are going to lead in the capture of your discussion. So what's your response to that argument?
I don't think it's a good argument. That is, again, I've got a very, we should probably have a whole separate podcast than my canned history of the last 60 years. But I think the standard anti-neoliberalism history is not a good history or a good account of it, right? Mm-hmm. I do think there was part of what you were saying, that there were lots of programs in the 60s that didn't work. Part of what people associate with neoliberalism is what I call recalibrationism, right? That is, there's a part of liberals, right? People who are actually liberals, and they were looking at this and saying, you know, a lot of the stuff we did, including when we were in government, didn't work so well, right? So some of that is also people who were, you know, helped pass environmental legislation in the beginning of the 1970s. And then by the late 1970s, early 80s, they say, look, all we haven't gotten hardly anything, right? All these things have been delayed. We should be doing, you know, carbon taxing, or in this case, it was, you know, sulfur dioxide taxing, right? That was not neoliberal. That wasn't Hayek. That wasn't Mises. That wasn't any of that, right? Mm-hmm. That was sort of the normal recalibration of a government that was suddenly into lots of new stuff that it wasn't into before, right? I do think there's this other part of it that we associate with Reagan, Thatcher, Hayek, right? That is a different, has a different basis, right? But none of that necessarily predetermined the growth of this massive subsidy and protection of finance, housing, and all these other, and intellectual property, all these other sectors, right? I think that was partially a function of the fact of the growth in the organization of those sectors, right? The fact that they were able to organize at a period in which the organization of working people was starting to become hollowed out, right? So the agenda was increasingly being controlled by those sectors that were seeking that enormous subsidy and upward redistribution. And they were dominating the agenda, in some sense, the agenda of both parties, right? And so I think that's a better way to make this account, is it's a big multi-causal kind of mess that people want to pull into this single, you know, neoliberalism that's like this, you know, this ghost that sort of took over everything and sucked everybody's brains out. And I think that's just bad history. Mm.
Well, as you say, it's a whole other podcast in and of itself. Steve, it's been a really good conversation, man. Seriously, you really got me thinking about the factions. I recommend everybody go and read that essay just in terms of how coalitional politics and more. Also, go read all of Steve's books, which we will have links to
at our bookshop.
If you're going to purchase it, get it from our bookshop. And with that, Steve, appreciate it, man. It will not be your last appearance on the podcast. I can tell you that for sure.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Hey guys, thanks for listening to the episode. We really appreciate it. As always, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Subscribe to our Substack, therealignment.substack.com. Check out our bookshop for all of our recommendations and for many of the books of the guests that we have here on the show. What am I missing, Marshall? Am I missing anything?
You're missing a huge thank you to the Lincoln Network for supporting all of our great work. We will see you on Friday, and we will see the rest of you next week.